It was almost our first anniversary, and already so much had happened. Ernest had begun to live the life of a real writer, and I'd found out what it meant to be a writer's wife. We'd met some of the important people, we'd drunk a fair bit, and we'd laughed a lot. If I was still homesick, I never let on. Before long, the Bastille Day celebrations had begun. It was hot and noisy, and we shouldn't even have tried to sleep.
It'll be our anniversary soon.
Shall we go away?
Where would we go?
To Germany, or maybe Spain. I must see some bullfights.
Or we could stay here and get very drunk and make love.
We could do that now.
We could.
Ernest turned on his side and reached to touch my bare shoulder. Then he pulled me towards him. Afterwards, we lay there in the dark.
Shall I get up and shut the window?
It's too hot, and it won't help anyway. Just go to sleep.
Something's on your mind. Do you want to tell me what it is?
No point.
Perhaps if you talk about it, it'll make you feel better.
Doubt it.
I might be able to help, you know.
Shouldn't think so.
I love it when we make love.
Maybe that's half the trouble.
What do you mean?
There's something about it that makes me feel emptied out afterwards. And lonely, too.
But that's awful.
I'm sorry. It's nothing you've done.
The hell it's not? Let's never do it again. We don't have to. I promise I'll never mention it again.
Look, don't worry about it. Just tell me you love me.
I love you.
I kissed his hands and eyelids and tried to forget what he'd said.
Go to sleep now.
I'll do my best.
I'm getting up.
You're not going to work now.
I'm gonna try.
I knew I needed to stop worrying about what he'd said, but I kept going over and over it in my mind. I couldn't forget anything he'd ever said to me. That's just how it was. The summer stretched on this way, with time not moving at all. The headaches that had plagued me when I was a girl were coming back, and though I knew I shouldn't resent Ernest's working or try to keep him from it, I was always happiest when he said he wasn't going to try to write it all that day.
I've got a great idea. Let's go to the races.
I thought you wanted to work.
I'm not in the mood.
Well, you could go and try anyway, just for a few hours.
It won't come to anything. I know it.
Our maid, Marie Cocotte, packed a basket with sandwiches and wine, and we set off for the train to Auteuil. I felt the pressure in my head lift, whooshing out quickly, like a ghost being exorcised from a house. I felt guilty for how happy it made me feel not to share him with his writing. Guilty and happy, all at the same time. That day, following a hunch, I wanted to bet on a horse called Chèvre d'Or that was running at 120-1. I'd been lucky before, and I felt sure I would be lucky again.
Are you still stuck on this horse?
Mm-hmm. I've got a good feeling about it.
Just as well. There's 6 months of living expenses riding on it.
You don't mean it. Maybe we better not.
What the hell with that? I love it when you take a chance. When you're not my normal cautious little cat.
My horse took the lead from the start. By the second hurdle, nothing could touch him. He was 4 lengths ahead by the fourth hurdle, a brandy-colored blur. Then he was 10 lengths ahead of the field, then 20.
Come on.
Come on. You can do it. Come on. Come on. Go on. Go on. Yes. Come on. Yes.
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
As beautiful as the rest had been, that's how ugly it was when he fell at the last jump. It was so terrible I couldn't watch. I buried my head in Ernest's shoulder and didn't see the end of the race. I cried half the way home on the train, through the gloomy neighborhoods with the clotheslines and the garbage and the children dressed in rags, trying hard to forget what I'd seen. That summer, we celebrated our first anniversary, a whole year of married life. Most of it had been fun, a real adventure, the two of us inventing an entirely new life for ourselves in Paris. But I had to admit that it hadn't been altogether blissful, that sometimes I'd been a little lonely. Perhaps that's how marriage was, I thought. One day a telegram came for Ernest from the Star. The editor wanted him to go to Turkey to cover the conflict that had erupted there.
What's the matter? I won't be gone long. It'll be like Genoa, the same as that. And then I'll be home and we'll be together again.
I'd never told him how low I'd been the last time he was away, how every day had been a struggle against myself.
I don't want you to go.
What?
Tell them you can't. Tell them I'm ill.
You're not making any sense.
I'm only telling the truth for once.
No, you're just being childish. This is a tantrum, and I want you to stop it now. Will you stop that? You know how I hate you crying. Look, why can't we simply be happy?
That's all I want.
Oh, for the love of God. I need a cup of tea.
Can't we pretend the telegram never came?
You know we can't.
Here, let me do that.
Oh, forget the damn tea.
But I just want...
Oh, go to hell.
I knew he'd gone to a cafe. I could have found him easily, and it might have been fine then if I had. We could have had a brandy and water and agreed to put it behind us, or ask the waiter to bring the absinthe and let it erase everything beautifully. But I stayed where I was and drank the damn tea, and a good deal of brandy, too. When I was drunk enough to do it, I picked up the lovely china teapot which we'd brought from home and let it drop to the floor with a crash. I meant to leave the pieces there for him to see, but that felt too small and childish. I hated feeling so desperate and out of control, but couldn't find a way out of it. So I went to bed with my head swimming and tried to sleep.
Hadley, let's not do this. Please, little cat. Damn you, I know you're awake. I said let's stop this right now. It's the job. You know I have to go.
You don't have to go. You want to.
You're not listening to me, are you? Oh, to hell with you anyway.
Maybe he went back to his writing room on the Rue Descartes. I don't know. He stayed out until noon the next day and then came back to pack.
You might need more shirts.
How the hell would you know what I need?
Teddy.
You said you'd never do this.
He was right. Over and over, I'd sworn I'd never stand in the way of his work. I'd believed it was my role as his wife to help him carve out a path for himself, to support him in every way I could. But at that moment, part of me didn't understand those promises at all. Part of me wanted him to be as unhappy as I was. Maybe then he'd give in and stay. But he didn't. We didn't speak or touch for 3 days, and when he left on the 25th of September, he was so hurt and angry that I could barely stand to look at him. I stood at the door and watched him struggle with his bags on the stairs. Towards the bottom, he dropped the case holding his typewriter. It fell hard, bounced with a sickening clatter, then fell again. He kicked it angrily before picking it up. When he got to the door at the bottom of the stairs, he kicked that too, and then I heard nothing. When he was gone, I felt sad and guilty, hating myself for what I'd done. All I could do was hope that he'd be safe, and that the thread that bound us was strong enough to weather the damage done. At the end of October, in the very early morning, Ernest stepped off his train at the Gare de Lyon, looking as if he'd been in a terrible battle and lost. He was weak and exhausted and feverish with malaria. He'd lost 20 pounds or more. I hardly recognized him.
I'm so sorry for everything.
It doesn't matter now.
He didn't leave his bed for a week. I just watched him sleep, knowing by the look of him that he'd suffered in ways he wouldn't be able to tell me about, not for a long time. After a week, he could get out of bed and bathe and dress. He went to his duffel bag and took out 2 presents he'd bought me, a bottle of attar of roses and...
Oh, and an amber necklace? It's the most beautiful necklace I've ever seen. I'm going to wear it always.
It belonged to an extremely important Russian diplomat who's now a waiter.
I knew he loved me again. I could see that. No matter what each of us had felt or thought during our weeks apart, it was behind us now. I felt we'd overcome something without ever naming it. But nothing was ever that simple with Ernest. He never left things as they were for very long. It was as if he was always setting a new test for me to pass or fail. Only I never seemed to know the rules or what I was expected to do or say.
I love your Michigan stories.
Is that true?
Yes, of course.
Sometimes I wonder if you want me writing at all. I think it makes you feel lonely.
It's not the writing that makes me feel lonely. It's your being gone. It's been so long since you've even tried to write at home. I promise I wouldn't talk or disturb you.
You know I have to go away to make anything happen. I have to be alone to get it started. But if I was really alone, that wouldn't work either. I need to leave that place and come back here and talk to you. That makes it real. Do you get what I'm saying?
I think so.
I put my head on his shoulder, rubbing my face into his neck. But the truth was, I didn't understand. Not really. And he knew. The trouble was, he knew. Near Thanksgiving, 1922, the Star sent Ernest to cover a peace conference in Lausanne.
You can come, too. We've got the money.
I don't have to. I'll be all right this time.
I want you there. It'll make it all so much more fun.
When we were due to leave, I was ill in bed and couldn't travel. We decided that he'd go alone and I'd follow on when I felt better. By the time I felt well enough to join him, it was early December. I packed happily, knowing that when the conference was over, we'd have a long skiing holiday in Switzerland. As I packed, I thought about how long we'd be gone and how anxious Ernest would be to return to his stories and his novel. Also, he'd cabled to say that a journalist he'd met in Genoa wanted to see everything he'd written so far, but he only had one thing with him, a story called My Old Man. It went without saying that he'd like to show more of his work to this guy, so I went to the cupboard where he kept all his manuscripts, gathered everything together, and packed it in a small valise, every last word of it. That was to be my surprise for him. When I boarded the train, I put the valise under my seat. We had half an hour before departure, so I went to stretch my legs and buy a newspaper. When I returned to the carriage, everything was just as I'd left it, except for the small valise. It wasn't under the seat. I couldn't see it anywhere. In a panic, I called for the conductor. My companion in the carriage tried to be helpful.
Is there something I can do? I can lend you something of mine to wear.
It isn't clothing. You don't understand.
The conductor fetched two policemen. I stood on the platform while they examined my papers and interrogated me, whilst everyone stared.
C'est la valise de mon mari. My husband's. Il est en Suisse. Switzerland. He's a writer. It's his work. 3 years' worth of work. Stories, poems, articles. The beginnings of a novel.
They didn't understand at all. But the conductor agreed to hold the train for another 10 minutes whilst the police performed their search. I didn't believe that whoever had stolen the valise was still on the train. It was probably a common thief who simply assumed it was full of valuables. Instead, it contained every thought and sentence Ernest had sweated over since we came to Paris, and well before. What would I do? How could I ever tell him? When I finally returned to my carriage, I was weeping uncontrollably.
Was it something precious?
The train grumbled beneath us, then lurched away from the platform with finality. There was no stopping or changing anything now, no avoiding the terrible truth of what had happened.
It was priceless. Absolutely